You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. The Sacred and the Profane, Objectivism and Religion by Aaron Smith.
I didn't, as an individual, I didn't really have a kind of profound experience with religion at all growing up. I grew up in, I guess, a religious home. My parents were both religious. I guess they were Baptist. I didn't know much else. They didn't talk politics. I don't even know if they voted. I didn't know if they were Republicans or Democrats. We didn't talk about ideas in the house at all. But it was a religious home, and I had a happy childhood. We went to church, Sunday school. I abandoned that early, but that was just because the person leading the Sunday school talked to me and my brother like babies, so we just sort of like stepped out of that. We didn't like that. But we couldn't process what was going on in a main sermon, like for the adults and stuff, so we just sort of hung out. But we went to church. Parents were religious. Taught to believe in God. But they weren't theologians or anything, so we didn't grow up with a lot of like arguments and theoretical structure and anything like that. So the experience wasn't super profound. I remember when we moved from, where were we moving from? Florida to Virginia, when I was about 7, we had to go church shopping, you know, because you have to go find it, you have to find a new church, you know. And so we went around and visited some places. And I remember one that we went to, they talked a lot about the need to be saved, and to accept Jesus Christ into your heart, and that's how you get saved and you go to heaven. And so I remember hearing that, and I think it was the first time I actually processed that and remembered that. I remember thinking about that. I was like, it's like, Mom, am I saved? I remember asking her, and she said, oh, yeah, you know, we did this when you were younger, you did this little, there's like a little ceremony or something like that. I don't remember that. And oh, honey, come on! It was like, yeah, we've done this. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah, I don't remember that. It's like, can we do that again? Because I was like, I mean, this sounds like this is an important issue. You know, I'm not taking that on faith. You know, so they agreed, and I did the Sarah. I mean, I don't know what it was about. I mean, I think I just had to agree. Like, I had to say something. Like, it was like, I remember there was a little door and a little room. We talked to some minister or something, and I said, you know, I accept Jesus Christ into my heart or something. I don't even know what that means. But it was like, look, there's something you got to do. It's what gets you into heaven, and otherwise you're in a lot of trouble. And I want to know firsthand that this is exactly, you know, like I got it covered. So I think I was already not fit for faith at that point. Then the next moment in my religious history is I was 11. We were all lined up in elementary school, go to the cafeteria or something. It was a blue tile wall. We were standing across from the restrooms, I remember. And that's the point I remember thinking, I just don't believe it. Like, I don't buy it. And it wasn't anything deep. From some perspective, it's deep, but not really. Not in my head. It was just that I don't get it. Like, I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me. That's the only way it stood in my head, was it doesn't make sense to me. And the next move in my head was, yeah, I don't buy it. And then when, I think I was about 16 or 17, when I started to be more able to think about things like this, I started reconsidering it, because I was like, this is important, you know. And I think that's about the time I met my first atheist in high school. And he was just positively irreverent, which I wasn't, but he was. And it was, in a way, kind of refreshing but weird. But then I thought about it more, I think, then in the sort of lead up toward like getting out of high school and stuff, and I was like, no, I don't buy it at all. And then that was pretty much a confirmed atheist at that point. But I never grew up. It was funny. I told my parents about this. They weren't too worried, which made me also wonder what that's about. But and then later on, I studied philosophy, was a professor for a while, and had a very interesting experience with regard to that. So when I would teach like an introduction to philosophy class, we typically would spend like 5 weeks on the issue of God. And that's a lot of time to spend, but partly because you can, there's a lot to cover, whether you're going over arguments for the existence of God or, I mean, it has to do with all sorts of things. The issue of God's related to ethics. It's related to your views of the world, about how you reach knowledge. There's all sorts of things it's related to. But what was fun is at the university where I was teaching, there were a lot of people coming from all sorts of different backgrounds, a lot of first-generation Americans, second-generation. So in every class, literally every intro class, because it would have like maybe 50, 60 people, we would have Christians, Jews, Muslims, definitely in every class, and typically a few Hindus and every once in a while a Buddhist, typically from Southeast Asia. But what was fun there, and I think refreshing or uncomfortable, one of the two, for the students is they're not even all monotheists. And that's worth sort of stressing, is that most people, and I think most might be underestimating, people arrive at the religious views that they do purely by the accident of birth. It's like what country you were from, what parents, what your parents were. Not everybody, of course, because sometimes you have a mixed, like mom's Jewish, dad's Muslim or whatever. But I think very few people attempt to arrive at their views about religion by assessing world religions and looking at the different options that are on the table and trying to figure out which one is more likely to be true, which one has, I don't know how you would assess it, but the best evidence or something like that. And it's very rare that people do that. And that's something of a sign, I think. And when I also realized that, it's like, that's a really important factor. That for many people, it's purely arbitrary. Which religion, not religion as such, but which religion is often purely arbitrary. It's not always, but. And one last little personal thing, and then we'll get out of that, is I hear it often said, and there's something to this, but I don't think it's what is normally thought of, is I get the question a lot, isn't there a need, like a real human need in some sense for religion? Like, doesn't it answer a real need? And don't we need religion in some respect? There is something to that, because there is something that you need that I think religion in some sense provides. But I know just speaking for myself that, and this is why it's harder for me to kind of get into the head of someone who takes religion very seriously, is I've never felt that need. I don't know what to say about that, but that's just, it's just never been an aspect of, I don't know, my psychology, my thinking, I don't know. But and then last thing is, so at ARI, at ARI, whether it's we're interviewing interns or we're speaking to student audiences at OCON or other kinds of events. We also have a student conference that we do in, October or something, in Atlanta. And this is one of the most common questions we get asked is the relationship between objectivism and religion. Part of it is because sometimes people get attracted to objectivism through groups in the various sort of liberty movement type groups, and some of them are coming from more conservative backgrounds, and so they're moving from a conservative background where religion has played a prominent role, and they become interested in objectivism, and so it's a real view for them. It's like, well, one way it's formulated is, can I have both? I'm coming from a religious home, a religious background, it's been a part of the way of thinking about the world, and they discover Rand, and they're really interested in Ayn Rand and the ideas, and they're taken by the characters and so on. And there's, can you have objectivism and religion at the same time? Are they compatible? And so sometimes it's just asked from a purely philosophical standpoint, like what's objectivism's view on religion? And sometimes it's, do I have to give up religion? Or can I, like I asked a couple of our current interns to write a few questions that they had about this. And one of the questions was, can I be an objectivist in my professional life and be religious in my personal life? And yeah, so it's, and on the one hand, there's a perspective from which, like, that's kind of a funny question. And then on the other hand, like, psychologically, I can sympathize with someone who finds, I think, something that they really don't want to give up, and something that it does something for them, it's important for them in some way, but then also be really attracted to something else that really does something for them, and it's important to them, and it's a kind of a clash, and they don't know what to make sense of it. But so we can start with the compatibility issue. One is there's a similarity between religion and philosophy. And I think it was in Ayn Rand's interview that she did with Playboy, in what was it, 64, something like that, where she said, religion is like a primitive philosophy. In a sense, it's mankind's first groping for a sense of, to make sense of the world. So both religion and a philosophy offer a worldview. So it's a conception of the nature of the world, of human nature, of man's place in the world, and in some sense, guidance on who to be and how to live. And that, so when people say, do you have a need for religion? I would say, I don't think you have a need for religion, but you have a need for that. You have a need for a worldview, something to, so you can make sense of your place in the world and like, where do I live and what do I do? And how do I understand myself? And so religion offers a perspective on that and a framework for thinking about that, and so does a philosophy. So in some sense, they cover similar ground. But I take it that the essence of a religious conception of the world, I mean, my familiarity is largely in Christianity, but of a religious conception of the world is the notion of the supernatural. And I think that if you didn't have the notion of the supernatural, I think what you have is not a religion. You could have a way of life, but if there's no afterlife, there's no supernatural dimension or realm, there are no supernatural beings that can do things that things in nature can't. Then you just have nature. And in that regard, there are some worldviews that often are considered or classified as religions, but they don't have gods. I'd have to look at what particular ones those are. I think some aspects of some sections, parts of Buddhism. But again, I think I would classify that more as like a worldview. And they could have mystical elements in various kinds of ways. And philosophies can be mystical in certain ways. So there's not always a bright line between a mystical philosophy and a religion. I mean, in Plato's philosophy, from a certain perspective, there's a sense in which there is some sort of a mystical aspect to that. None of the Greek philosophers accepted the gods of traditional Greek religion, which is interesting at the time. But nonetheless, the notion of the supernatural is a major difference between that and, I think, most philosophies, certainly objectivism. So when it comes to metaphysics or your kind of general conception of the nature of the world, for objectivism, there's just nature. So there is no realm outside of nature. I mean, if you think about what is the supernatural supposed to be, in essence, I think what it is it's a realm that's not bound by natural laws. And if you dig down a little deeper into that, I think it's a realm that's not bound by identity and causality. In other words, it's a realm in which things don't behave in restricted ways as a result of the properties that they have. That things can do anything, be anything, engage in any kinds of activities that are not determined by or fixed by or as a product of determinate features and properties that they have. So in objectivism, the view is that everything that exists has a particular identity, has a particular set of properties, and that set of properties is what determines how they act. It's what determines how they interact. So things have limited abilities, and in any given situation, whatever the outcome is of an interaction, it's going to be the result of the properties that the things have. If everything is like that, then there's no space for miracles, because things can't happen. Bushes can't speak, if you know that miracle. There's no place for miracles. Another aspect of the supernatural, the issue of the supernatural, is that, and I think this is part of the appeal, is that a divinity can do anything. So a divinity isn't bound by an identity that is fixed or determinate or limited. And I think that's really one of the appeals of the idea of a god, is that one doesn't have to be bound by the absolutism of nature. And that there's someone out there, so to speak, who can make things other than they are and other than they must be. And from a psychological standpoint, I think that's a major appeal of religion, is that, if you think about just from the psychological aspect, it's death isn't the end. I'll get to meet perhaps a loving father after death. This isn't my only shot at life, in effect. It's like, this isn't all there is. So maybe this life didn't go well. Maybe I screwed it up. Maybe just had a lot of suffering in my own life, or just doubts about myself. And just the whole notion that there's someone out there that loves me, and that I can go to a place where there's no pain, there's no frustration, there's no suffering, there's no fear. There's just love, happiness, bliss, peace. Now that I can understand why someone would be interested in that. Peace of mind. What's that?
72 virgins.
Yeah. So, if you put it one way, it's there's a place where there's no pain and no fear, and there's just peace of mind. Like, peace of mind is good, right? I can see why that would have a real pull on someone. So I think part of it is, for that to be the case, you have to invest in the supernatural. I mean, there has to be a notion of that. And so, hence the opposition to everything about, it's science has answers to things, and it's like that whole view has to be pushed aside, because it has to be wrong from a religious perspective. Let's go to the epistemology thing. So now we'll move from a little bit from the kind of worldview to epistemology, or the issue about knowledge. Because of the fact that religions rely on a notion of the supernatural, there's an element of the unknowable. I think it's inherent in the notion of the supernatural is the unknowable. You can't know the supernatural. That's kind of the point. And so inherent in that is faith. Because if you can understand something, if you can grasp that 2 and 2 is 4, or that the seeds grow into flowers, and you can observe it and you can establish its truth, you don't need faith for it. You don't need to have faith. So in any area where there's actual knowledge and understanding, there's no place for faith. because you know. And that's why, that's another reason why religions have to be invested in the notion of, yeah, but there's a realm beyond what reason can know. And that's the realm where it's okay to have faith about that. Because if the universe is just intelligible, there is no place for faith, and there would be no use for it in one's methodology. You would follow the methods that we use to reach all sorts of other knowledge, which is geology or medicine or philosophy or any other field. But if you think about like what faith, I mean, from an objectivist perspective, what you think about it is like, well, but what is faith when you think about that from an epistemological perspective, like from faith as a method or means of coming to know or to have a belief. If you think about faith from that perspective, I mean, if you look up faith in like the Catholic Encyclopedia or something, like 17 different definitions of faith. But if you think about it from the perspective of knowledge, I think Rand typically defines this as something like it's the belief in an idea.
Non-sensory.
Well, yeah, it's something like, I should have looked this up, I guess, but this is always on call. It's in the absence of sensory evidence or rational proof. It's belief in something in the absence of sensory evidence or rational proof. I like to put it slightly differently and say, in spite of. It's not always the case that it's without any evidence or something like that. I mean, she put it right, without sensory evidence. Well, there's no sensory evidence. Like, you don't observe God, I hope. And a rational proof is not the same thing as, you know, well, what about the Gospels? And we dug up something in Syria. So there is a respect in which, you know, religious people will often, depends on the person, will bring forward some kinds of evidence. So I don't like to think about it as much as it's in the absence of evidence or something like that, because they'll put, there's all these questions about what counts as evidence and so on, but they will wheel out evidence or the arguments and so on. But I think what it amounts to, though, is it's the acceptance of an idea or maintenance of an idea irrespective of what the evidence and the arguments show. So when I was teaching at University of Maryland, I had a student in my class, in my philosophy class, where we're doing the issue of religion. And he came to my office hours, and he wanted to talk about God, and he had a proof. And he said, okay, I want to try this proof on you. You tell me what you think. So I don't even remember what the proof was. But so he brought one out, and I showed him at least what I thought was wrong with it. And he said, okay, hold on, I got another one. And this went on for about three, I don't know why it didn't dawn on me early, but a little dim maybe. But so after about the third proof, he looks like he's gearing up for another one. And I just paused for a second and I said, hang on, so suppose you give me all your arguments. You got 19 of them. And I show you why none of them are cogent. Would you give up your belief in a God? Would you be an atheist? And to his credit, he sat there thinking for a little bit, like taking it seriously. And after a while, he's like, no, I don't think I would. And I said, well, that's important to know. I mean, it's important to know about, you know, how that idea stands in your mind. Is that, and if you put it in, if you articulate that point, it's, this is a belief I hold irrespective of the arguments, irrespective of the evidence, no matter what the arguments in the evidence show. So what are we doing here? Like, this is a pretense. It's as if you want to show that you're playing the rational game that I'm playing, so to speak, but we're not really playing the same game. You're trying to find a way to maintain that belief and to gain some sort of sense of support. Like, my view is rational, but if you dig down, you figure that's not really what you're doing. It's important to know, because then you need to start thinking about, is that a good way to come at my ideas? Would I treat other areas in my life like that? Well, it doesn't matter what the evidence is. Is that a good way to populate your mind with ideas? I don't know where this guy is now, but I think that, it's a good point. And so one of the things when I think about faith, I think of it as acceptance of an idea on emotional grounds rather than intellectual grounds. Because if you accept an idea on intellectual grounds, the idea in your mind is going to stand or fall with the evidence. If it turns out, yeah, the argument I thought was really, really nailed it, it actually doesn't work. What that should cause, if you accept it on intellectual grounds, is some doubt about whether you've got the right idea or not. And if that's not what it causes, it's something you're trying to hang on to, irrespective of reason. In my view, and it's certainly an objectivism's view, faith is a complete dead end, like a complete dead end. And there are a couple, she puts it as it's a short circuit to knowledge. So it's worse than a dead end. If I'll remember, I'll say something about that. But one thing is that if I accept something purely on the basis of faith, and it's not really on the basis of arguments, and you accept something different on the basis of faith, there's no way by faith alone to adjudicate between which one's true or not. So you can't distinguish between the true and the false if what you're doing is faith. Reason is your means of determining what's true or false. So if I believe in three gods and you believe in one, and on the basis of faith, there's nothing we can talk about. I can't say, well, the reason... Oh. So in all of the... So reason always has to do any of the heavy lifting, or the only lifting, the light lifting. All the lifting has to be done by reason. So if you think about that, so if somebody is a polytheist and I want to show, no, you're wrong, there's only one God, okay, I'm done. Right? If that's faith. If it's reason, it's, well, God is the most, it's standard theology. God is the most perfect being. There can't be a variety of most perfect beings, because if it's the most, it's the superlative in perfection, then there can only be one. So there are ways of trying to establish that point. But what's that? You're trying to engage in reasoning. You're trying to establish this is true because it somehow has to logically follow from the nature or properties of the entity we're talking about. So in any time you want to establish something, it's done by reason. So really, if what you're trying to do is establish a factual question, it's a factual question. There either is or there ain't a supernatural being. And if you want to try to establish that as a factual issue, as opposed to assuage one's emotional worries or whatever, but if what you're doing is you're trying to hit that factual question, you got to engage in reason. This is the only way to do it. So if you can prove the existence of a God, good for you. But that's the only way in which you could try to legitimately establish that. Now, you can argue on certain kind of practical grounds, pragmatic grounds, and I hear this all the time as well, is, okay, so fine. You can't prove the existence of God, okay, whatever, but come on. I mean, what's so bad about it? I mean, if it gives somebody comfort, why push on them, right? Why take that away from them? And one of the questions, again, I got from the interns. It's funny because you have to read exactly how they're formulated because it's how it stands in their mind. Sorry. I'm not chuckling at the intern. I'm just chuckling because, well, multiple things. But can objectivism truly replace the feel-good that religion offers? If so, how? And that, I think that kind of captures it. Like there's something in the way in which it makes me feel good. I'm more comfortable. Maybe I'm more optimistic, as William James said. It makes me more optimistic, more hopeful, optimistic might be good. Hopeful might be good. But I would say, you know, well, there's a lot of things you could say to that. If you agree with the position I'm putting forward, but there isn't an afterlife. So this is all there is. And so I think if the idea is, well, what's wrong with hoping that there's an afterlife? What's wrong with hoping that there's a loving father watching out for me? It's because there isn't. And you have to take control of your own life. And you got not a lot of time. So and I think what happens, and is a little trivial sort of joke, but how many Sundays I wasted as a kid? It's like, Mom, I got 2 days, and then I got to go back to school, you know, and I've got chores and everything, and I'm sitting there in church, you know. Mostly I just slept. But it was, it's a real redirection of one's, I think, time, one's energy, away from the things that are actually important, the things that are actually real, the things in your life, your limited time, your efforts. And there's a real way in which you cannot deal with things that you really need to deal with, because you can say, well, I guess it turned out that way because God wanted it that way. And it's, no, you just got fired. That's nothing. It's not, maybe God wants me to pursue a new, it's totally arbitrary. Because A, there's no actual way to know any of that anyway. So what you wind up doing is, well, maybe, and then you wind up being very complacent about a lot of things that happen, because on the assumption that, well, it's for the good. It must be for the good, right? Because God's watching. God wouldn't do anything bad to me. Or it's, yeah, you know, God ensured I got fired because I'm guilty or something like that. And it's the whole way of dealing with your own worries about, like, am I on the right path? Am I doing what's right and what's good? And to think, well, whatever happens must be for the good. You really don't deal with the problems in the way that you ought to in this life. And I don't think one prioritizes one's time in the right kind of way. Because once you really realize, you know, you got, what am I, 45? So I got another 40 years. Who knows? Depends on my fast living. I live slow. It's, you got a limited time, and you really got to take that life seriously in what you're doing. And the hoping for some other world is not the way to do it. And then there's the whole perspective of ethics. So there's the metaphysical issue is, like, there's a belief in a supernatural world where the regular rules don't apply, and a supernatural being that doesn't have to follow any of them. And then in the case, which is unknowable, the whole realm is unknowable. And then you have faith, because the whole belief is you're believing in something that's inherently unknowable. Is that you have to rely on a method of acquiring beliefs about those important things, which is unreliable. That's a problem. And then when it comes to ethics, religions will place the most important things, the most valuable things, the things most worthy of attention, reverence, and so on, outside of this world, in the person of a god or a heaven and so on. And in Rand's view, all values are in this world. Wait, there isn't another world. So everything that's valuable, everything that's important, everything that's significant, that's worth paying attention to, focusing on, revering, and so on, is here. I remember when I knew Ayn Rand and she was 12. I remember reading in Rand's journal, she said that when she was young, I think she was maybe 12 or something, she rejected the notion of God. It wasn't on the basis of a philosophical argument. It was something like, the whole concept is degrading to man. I mean, it's, and I think she had a lot of sympathy with Nietzsche on this little point, is that if you create some other world where things are good and right and perfect and clean, it necessarily devalues this world. Like this, well, why make the other world? Because it's better than this one. This world's no good. And that's very common in a certain kind of stream of philosophy, like Plato, for example. This world's muddy, unclear, not very knowable, not very good. People are bad. But there's this other world. And also, the notion of treating someone like Jesus as a moral ideal, as the highest possible, as the most pure and noble and good, and then to have the ideal allow himself to be tortured and killed for the non-ideal. She was like, that's monstrous. Your response to the ideal and the ideal's response to himself is to throw his life away for the sinners and the bad and the sinful and the botched. That's horrible. It's a horrible way to think about an ideal. And so that was early on. She's like, this is terrible. Of course, he didn't stay dead, so he woke up after a few days, so he gave up a weekend. But nonetheless, that's the idea. And you get this a lot, and I see this on little memes on Facebook and things like that. That's where I get all my knowledge. And they have these graphic kind of pictures that he died for your sins. And people take it like really like he, but and the, so but if you think about that is, you owe him, and you're a sinner, and it's like anybody with self-respect I think would looks at that and goes, okay, I'm not saying I didn't make any mistakes, I'm not saying that I didn't do anything that's like yeah I shouldn't have done that, but the notion that one is inherently a sinner, yeah, that one is inherently a sinner. And one must constantly try to expiate that sin, to make up for it, to do, it's like, again, it's a, I'm trying to be moderate. I'm a middle of the roader. No, I think that's a horrible thing to put on someone. And Rand's view is that that makes ethics impossible. If the idea is you're inherently a sinner no matter what you do, and you constantly have to beg for forgiveness no matter what because of something over which you have no control, it's like once it's outside of your control, it has nothing to do with ethics. It's like apologizing for having brown hair. It's like, really sorry. It's like it's not up to you. And the whole notion of original sin, which is not, I mean, Ayn Rand had a lot to say about that. But Rand, despite having an atheist, it's funny to say an atheist philosophy, sounds weird. She's an atheist, and she has a philosophy. Atheism, I guess it's like, I guess maybe this is common knowledge, but atheism is not a philosophy. It's just the rejection of a particular sort of view. You can be an atheist and a communist, an atheist and an objectivist. You can be an atheist for good reasons or bad reasons. Maybe your mom ran off with the priest, right? And you're angry, you know. But there are a lot of irrational reasons for becoming an atheist. And that there are reasonable ones. And I think if your reasons are, you know, if this doesn't make sense, it doesn't meet any kind of rational standards for truth or warrant or, you know, then that's fine. But so what Rand doesn't do, though, is reject the notions of reverence, of the notions of something being sacred. And in this case, I want to read you just a section from the introduction to The Fountainhead. It's a book she wrote. She says, "Religion's monopoly in the field of ethics has made it extremely difficult to communicate the emotional meaning and connotations of a rational view of life. Just as religion has preempted the field of ethics, turning morality against man, so it has usurped the highest moral concepts of our language, placing them outside this earth and beyond man's reach." And she gives some examples. Exaltation is usually taken to mean an emotional state evoked by contemplating the supernatural. Worship means the emotional experience of loyalty and dedication to something higher than man. Reverence means an emotion of sacred respect to be experienced on one's knees. Sacred means superior to and not to be touched by any concerns of man or of this earth. But such concepts do name actual emotions, even though no supernatural dimension exists. And these emotions are experienced as uplifting or ennobling without the self-abasement required by religious definitions. What then is their source or referent in reality? It is the entire emotional realm of man's dedication to a moral ideal, yet apart from the man-degrading aspects introduced by religion. Yet apart from the man-degrading aspects introduced by religion, that emotional realm is left undefined without concepts, words, or recognition. Like, what words do you use when those emotions, those ennobling, uplifting sort of emotions of feel like of looking up to something higher, to something of the highest possible value, to the ideal, to the perfect, to the things that you would want to aspire to? What the sacred? Reverence? worship. I mean, but they're so connected to the supernatural, the experience you have toward the supernatural. And it's another way in which this is embodied in language. The idea that you would have a feeling of sacred respect or reverence for something of this earth, I mean, that's just, that's blasphemy, so to speak, from that perspective. And one of the things that Rand's novels do in a way I think few, if any, other writers really do, is try to communicate that sense. She says, in this sense, with this meaning and intention, I would identify the sense of life dramatized in The Fountainhead as man worship. And she says, the quote, man worshipers, in my sense of the term, are those who see man's highest potential and strive to actualize it. So really a lot of what you get in The Fountainhead, I mean, there's religious language, you know, these kind of terms and things in The Fountainhead, but it's a redirection of reverence toward man and identifying what is it about man that's really worthy of reverence? see Howard Rourke. But she says, there's a section in the book that makes this clear, like how I stand on this, and it's the whole, who has not read The Fountainhead? It's okay to raise your hand, or just... Okay. Oh, good. I say good because you got a lot of fun stuff coming to your head. But where's the little passage? Here you go. So there's a passage. Okay. I will respect plot spoilers. So some guy wants the hero to build a really cool temple. Shh. And this is how the person speaks to Howard Rourke. He's an architect. He's the main character. This is how he speaks to Rourke about what he wants him to build. So you see, Mr. Rourke, though it is to be a religious edifice, it is also more than that. You notice that we call it the temple of the human spirit. We want to capture in stone, as others capture in music, not some narrow creed, but the essence of all religion. And what is the essence of all religion? The great aspiration of the human spirit toward the highest, the noblest, the best. The human spirit as the creator and conqueror of the ideal. The great life-giving force of the universe. The heroic human spirit. This is your assignment, Mr. Rourke. So that gives you a sense of when Ayn Rand thinks of something to revere and something worthy of reverence, it's the highest, how did she put it? The highest, the noblest, the best, the heroic human spirit. And she doesn't mean the Holy Spirit, just when she refers to the spiritual, she means the whole realm of man's consciousness, and particularly about values, and man's highest values. And later, a newspaper woman commenting on her assessment of the temple in contrast to another intellectual's assessment of the meaning of the temple.
So hard.
I'm measuring my words. Hold on. The chuckles are because everyone's read the book. So Howard Rourke built a temple to the human spirit. He saw man as strong, proud, clean, wise, and fearless. He saw man as a heroic being, and he built a temple to that. And a temple is a place where one comes... Sorry. A temple is a place where man is expected to experience exaltation. He thought that exaltation comes from the consciousness of being guiltless, of seeing the truth and achieving it, of living up to one's highest possibility, of knowing no shame and having no cause for shame, of being able to stand naked in full sunlight. He thought that exaltation means joy, and that joy is man's birthright. He thought that a place built as a setting for man is a sacred place. That is what Howard Rourke thought of man and of exaltation. But this other guy said that this temple was a monument to a profound hatred of humanity. He said that the essence of exaltation was to be... He said that the essence of exaltation was... It just made me chuckle. To be scared out of your wits and fall down and grovel. He said that man's highest act was to realize his own worthlessness and beg forgiveness. He said it was depraved not to take that for granted, that man is something which needs to be forgiven. He saw that this building was of man and of this earth, and he said that this building had its belly in the mud. To glorify man, he said, was to glorify the gross pleasure of the flesh, for the realm of the spirit is beyond the grasp of man. To enter that realm, man must come as a beggar on one's knees. He is a lover of mankind. He, the author of that kind of viewpoint. So there's two different viewpoints on man and, you know, where the reverence and the sacred ought to be placed. So let me stop talking. I think I've said enough now, and open this up for discussion. Yes, and do they need to come to the mic?
Oh, yeah. So you
can go first. I guess they're handing the mic around.
Start, and we'll bring it to you.
Good. So a lot of religions tend to be very anti-hedonistic. Like, not only that, but they insult the pleasures of this world. But at the same time, they have like these afterlives where they do get to experience the pleasures of this world. You know, there's Islam where they get a harem of 72 virgins. There's Mormonism where they get to have eternal cosmic orgies all the time.
What was it again?
Mormonism. And this has always kind of perplexed me. Like, why would you degrade the pleasures of this world while at the same time wanting them in another world?
To get people to accept the degrading of pleasures on this world.
Yeah.
If someone, I mean, oh, okay, that was a quick off-the-cuff answer, but I think from that perspective, it's like, why would you tell, you can live it up in the next world, but here, sacrifice. Because the point isn't you'll enjoy the next world. It's I want you to sacrifice here. I don't want you to be happy here. Mortify the flesh, don't have sex. That's it. That's the motive.
Okay.
And so, I mean, but if you tell people that, you're like, well, hold on. So there's no party at the end? Like, that's it? You might not find as many adherents. But if the idea is what you do, look, it's easy to be flip, but if the idea is, look, this is a brief span of time. And what the Creator demands is, look, you'll have to do some sacrifice here. But you have an eternity in another world where everything is better. Well, you'll be happy. And it's in that regard, it's not even a sacrifice. It's just an investment in that regard. And if you put it that way, you're like, oh, okay, I can get that. But if you say, look, here's what I'd like you to do. Sacrifice everything that's pleasurable and enjoyable on earth as an end in itself. You want to join? I think that's it. Yeah, I think there's something to that. Yeah. Yeah, this gentleman up here, I think.
First, I'd like to address this idea that Ayn Rand, as a 12-year-old, expresses that God is degrading humanity. Mm-hmm. I watched Ken Burns' World War II. And in that, a man expresses that the hero is the man who he saw was afraid and acted in spite of it. Mm-hmm. That magnificence is the sacred. And it's degraded by the idea that God's making him do it, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know how to put the words to it, but
well,
I...
You put it well enough.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, the idea is when you observe real heroism in some sense, or something magnificent, read Victor Hugo, by the way. You watch human beings doing magnificent things in action that are just awe-inspiring, and the idea is, well, somebody else did that. It's a way of cutting out any sort of like.
It steals the acknowledgement.
It does, yeah.
It glorifies altruism.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thinking about certain things like acts of heroism in altruistic terms, and that's where the heroism lies because it's altruistic, and you get that element of it. Whereas what's heroic about some of these actions sometimes is their magnificent commitment to life. You know, I mean, you don't, well, Yeah, so I answered that.
So I have a question associated with it. 50 years ago, I walked into the temple and was inspired to give up guilt. The temple was called Atlas Shrugged.
Welcome, brother.
Right. But I get it with the Rourke analogy. I mean, literally, that's what it was, the experience of entering a temple, which was dedicated to the magnificence of man and myself.
Yeah.
So I have a... In Atlas Shrugged, Dagny cannot give up the railroad. And I have a sense that that's equivalent to someone who is very important to me being unwilling to give up God. That it is as difficult for that person that I know to give up God as it is for Dagny to give up the railroad. Now, there's a little... I have a trouble with the yeah. equivalence.
Yeah. Well, in one case, it's a rational commitment to rational values that's integrated deeply in her life, her psychology, her whole approach to life is that the railroad and doing and growing the business and doing her utmost best, and that's a tremendously rational commitment. But that's part of the thing with religion is it's not just as if you thought there was an 11th planet and then somebody says there isn't and you're like, okay. It's religion is integrated into people's social lives, into their view of themselves, into how they assess themselves and how they deal with their emotional states. I mean, it's to put it negatively, it has their claws into every aspect of what's important in life. And to you can't just reach into the framework and rip out the framework. It's their framework. And that's the danger of religion, too. It starts to become very integrated into your whole framework. And to say, abandon that after is a tremendous psychological, like, difficulty. Dagny, well, while she should not abandon the attitude that she has to her railroad, because all of that's tied into what's rational and important, she comes to learn there are reasons why she does. But for religion, it ought to be given up. But I have no answer for that. It's the same thing. I don't know. You just stick my parents. I don't know what to do. But if it's someone you love also, you kind of also have the feeling is like, why rob them of that? But I don't think that's the right way to think about it.
There is a reason. There's a reason for why rob them of it.
Yeah, yeah. Because we've got something better.
While they hang on to that, they cannot go into the temple. They cannot experience that.
No.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Isn't it just that blanking out reality? Dagny does that. She blanks out reality, and that's what permits her to stay on that course.
I don't think she... So we could argue about Atlas Shrugged, but I don't think that she blanks out. I think she has I think the way Rand put it was, she's much too overconfident in both other people and their goodness and in her own ability to, like, basically fly. I say fly solo, but she actually does fly solo. But to manage the railroad in spite of everything that's going on in the world. And she thinks she can do it. We have to be strong, and if I just stick to it, and it's not... In that situation in the novel, it's not really true that she can maintain that forever, and that she doesn't really take the issue of evil seriously, or she doesn't get it that people are in fact, there are people that are actually evil. And so she thinks, if we just show them that this is, and they come to get, you see, this is ruining your lives, it's terrible for you, then they'll come, no, they're not. Not if that's the aim. You know, so she comes to learn some stuff about that. But Leopold.
Yeah. In regard to objectivism and atheism, I remember once hearing Dr. Peikoff saying that it's better to say I'm an objectivist and not an atheist because it's a negation of a god. And I would like to hear your exploration on that, because I think even the title, obviously from Atlas, is the right usage of word and owning the words, like you mentioned now in the introduction of the Fountainhead, like owning the right words. Yes, for example, my love to this woman is sacred, or I'm a man worship, or
yeah.
And I would like to hear that from an exploration on that.
Well, when it comes to things like sacred and man worship, I mean, be prepared to explain what you mean by that. But when it comes to things like, I mean, I say I'm an atheist, partly because, and just flat out, partly because it's stark. And I don't have a reason to hide it. If you say you're an objectivist, people might not know what you mean, because it's not, if I said I'm a Platonist, most people wouldn't know what I'm talking about either. I just say I'm an atheist, but I was in a bookstore once, I was in Barnes & Noble or something, and I was looking at some kind of exotic cuisine cookbook type things. And I was chatting with these really nice couple next to me, and they said, oh, so what do you do? What do you do? And I says, I am a philosopher. It's kind of always a silly thing to say. But no one knows what you're talking about. It sounds pretentious and stupid. But unless you're in Europe. And then it has some weight and some respect. But I said I'm a philosopher. I said, oh, but how do you rationalize your faith? After a while, it just gets tiring, because it's sort of like, I don't rationalize my faith. I don't have any faith, and what I do isn't rationalized. But I think when it comes to that, it's fine to just say you're an atheist, but I get the idea that I'm against X. That doesn't really tell you anything, but it can get a conversation started.
Last question. Maybe one more if you could.
Was a born-again Christian, and I went to a liberal arts religious college, which is a contradiction when you think about it. And by the time I came out of it, I was agnostic. Mm-hmm. And then I read Ayn Rand again. Mm-hmm. I had read it once, parts of it once in college, and didn't understand it at all. How could I? And as I've gotten older and older and older and older, the one thing that it comes down to, because I live in Indianapolis, Indiana, actually outside of it, mm-hmm. and where we live right now, I have a minister on one side and a born-again Christian on the other side.
Run.
And... And one day with the born-again Christian, I was asked, there were political things that we agreed with, uh-huh. and she said something, and I said to her, I'm an atheist, so what bothers you does not bother me. Uh-huh. And she said, oh, I feel so sorry for you. And, you know, why? And I said, because I don't believe that a wish or a hope is a part of reality. It is not knowledge to make decisions on. And then I started thinking about that, because what I've come to the decision of is why a wish and a hope is so bad is that once you give yourself that permission to believe on a wish and a hope...
That's the shortcut.
Yes.
Well,
not just a shortcut, but you've given everybody else that right. And that includes an Islamic terrorist. Mm-hmm. He's acting on what he or she believes is a hope or a wish. Yeah. And the only way we can get along in the world is if we can point to something and say, we can disagree on this color of this chair, but we can agree it's a chair.
Yeah.
And you have no way of doing that.
And it's the same thing within, and this is, I think, part of what Rand meant by saying that faith is a short, not just a shortcut, it's a short circuit. Because if what you do, like you said, if what you do is you say, it's okay to accept some things because I want to, and that without any rational warrant, then it introduces the arbitrary into your methodology. It's like, because then it's always an open question as to, well, am I going to do that same thing with the next belief?
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.